Hello and welcome, everyone, to the fifth session of the CEC Preliminary Assessment Site Inspection Webinar Series. This is Module 5, titled PA Scoring Exercise, Surface Water Migration Pathway. Today's webinar is sponsored by EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. I am Michael Adam of the same office, and I will be moderating today's session. We will get started in a few moments. Instructions on how to join today's webinar was sent via email when you registered for the event, as well as a reminder email. Since we're getting started so late, I'm going to try to skip over some of the things. The most important thing is that you guys are logged into the Adobe Connect platform. If you have any other technical questions, you can go ahead and send them to me through the Q&A window. You may go to the seminar homepage to download the slides. Please put your phone on mute. Do not put us on hold. With that, I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to today's speakers, Sandra Harrigan and Therese Joya. And Therese is first, so let's get started.
Okay.
Hold on. Let me get you your slides here.
Okay, great. All right, thank you, Mike. Welcome, everyone, to the surface water PA scoring portion of the PASI training and preliminary assessment site inspection training. This is the most frequently scored pathway. It beats out the groundwater pathway by about 1 percentage point. 51% of sites on the NPL have scored the surface water pathway. So the first thing you need to do is say that you have a surface water at your site, and there is a definition for surface water in HRS, and it's defined as naturally occurring and then some man-made perennial water bodies. And the water bodies have to be perennial unless you are in an arid area that has a mean annual precipitation of less than 20 inches. So some of those western states, you know, Nevada, Arizona, parts of California, would all qualify as arid areas. And in those cases, you can use an intermittent flowing water body. In all other parts of the country with mean annual precipitation of 20 inches or more, you would need a perennial flowing water body. And then if you you really need to have your surface water feature within 2 miles of your sources to score the surface water pathway. The surface water pathway is a little bit different. It has three threats: the drinking water threat, the human food chain threat, and the environmental threat. And you generate a threat score for each of those, and then and they factor in likelihood of release and waste characteristics, and then you add the three threats together to get your surface water pathway score. So these are the sorts of questions that you should be answering in your site assessment. First of all, the likelihood of release is what are those hazardous substances, and have they been released to surface water, or is there a potential for them to release to surface water? And that's the LR part of the equation. You also look at who or what could be impacted by the contaminated surface water, and those are your targets. And then your waste characteristics, or WC, is a combination of the amount of hazardous substances that have been disposed of at the site, what types they are, and, you know, how large those sources are. So this is the equation here. I need the little green thing, Mike, if you get a chance, the green pointer. So here's the equation here, LR times targets times WC divided by 82,500. And that is done for each of the threats. You get a score for each, the drinking water threat, the human food chain threat, and the environmental threat, and then you add them all together to get your pathway score. So contaminant release mechanisms that are taken into account for site assessment is flooding, where you might have the surface water flooding and coming into your sources. It could be overland flow from your source to your surface water feature. And then there's also this middle one. It's not scored very often, very infrequently. But if there was some reason that your sources were not getting to your nearby surface water, maybe there's some big barrier here that kept overland flow and flooding from occurring, you could evaluate whether your source is discharging its contaminants down through the subsurface, and that is reaching groundwater, and then that contaminated groundwater is discharging to the river. So there is a way to score groundwater discharge to surface water. It's called the other component. And you could score your site both ways, but then pick the way, the component that gives you the highest score. And like I said, the vast majority of surface water scoring is done with the overland and flooding component. So here are some data search questions that you should be answering during the preliminary assessment and the site inspection. You really need to define your overland segment, and that's defined as the point between the source and the flow path that the hazardous substances take from the source to the surface water where they first discharge. And you want to pick the source that gives you the shortest pathway, so you'd evaluate all your sources. And it can be a feature that's very obvious, such as a ditch. It might not be so obvious, and you would have to measure it or use a topographic map and see what the straight line path is from your source to your surface water. And then once you've defined where your sources enter the surface water, those are called the probable point of entries to the surface water. It has a acronym of PPE. You'll see that a lot, and it's very important that you identify your PPE or PPEs. You can have more than one. You should evaluate whether the site is subject to flooding and whether it might have been had flooding in the past. You can look back at historical site records and even media reports of flooding if you know flooding's been a problem in the area. You also want to know how frequently the site might flood, and that is really determined by what floodplain your sources reside in. So if you have several sources and they fall into different floodplains, you would look at the floodplain that gives you the most frequent flooding. And then finally, you look at, in terms of targets, you're also looking for any wetlands, which are a sensitive environment in the surface water pathway. And then there's a whole other list of sensitive environments that you have to become familiar with. And they are listed in Table 423 of the HRS rule. Gives a description of what the particular sensitive environment is, and it assigns a point value. And you can get very high point values. They range from 100 to 5 in that table. And Sandra and I will show you how to do that, how you actually take that into consideration when we get to the quick score part. You also need to define, now so you can see we're going to follow those hazardous substances from the sources to the surface water and then follow their migration pathway. And in the surface water, that migration pathway is called the in-water segment. So you want to define what the in-water segment is associated with the sources at your site. And you draw the in-water segment by figuring out what the 15-mile downstream target distance limit is. So in the surface water pathway, you have a 15-mile TDL with a few exceptions. The exceptions to that is if you are in a surface water body, a river or a stream that is tidally influenced, where you might have flow presumably upstream at some points during the day. So you can go upstream from your PPE if you have tidally influenced surface water body. In addition, if you can document that you have contamination that you can attribute to your sources and your site farther than the 15-mile TDL, you can extend the 15-mile TDL to where that contamination has been detected through sampling. So once you've defined what your overland segment is, your PPE or PPEs, your in-water segment, and where that TDL ends, then you would go back and look at all of the targets within that 15-mile TDL. So for the drinking water threat, we're mainly looking at drinking water intakes. And for the human food chain threat, we're looking more at fish production for human consumption. And then in the environmental threat, you're looking at sensitive environments. So you measure the overland segment. It should be the shortest distance that runoff from your sources would follow to reach the surface water. And during the PA, you can try to measure that during your site reconnaissance. If the distance is too great, you can also use a topographic map to indicate what that pathway might be. And then you would identify your probable point of entry or probable point of entries. You might have more than one. And that's the point at which the runoff from the site would likely enter surface water. And then you would make sure that you have a nice sketch at the PA stage. You'll want to have a good site sketch where you're identifying these various points, the sources, the overland segment that the hazardous substances would flow over, and the PPE, all of that on a nice site sketch. Now, a site can have more than one PPE, and if you do, then you're going to, and those PPEs define more than one watershed, then you would evaluate all of the watersheds and select the one that gives you the highest score. And the rule allows you to do that. So let's look a little bit at what this looks like from on a map. So here we have a site where we're going to show you kind of a simple one where your whole 15-mile TDL is in a stream or a river. So you can see we have our source here. We've identified a PPE that occurs right around here, and then we follow the meanders, any meanders of the river or the stream, all the way down for 15 miles, and we put a star here at the end of that. And then you'll want to note, as you measure your TDL, what other contributors you might have coming into that original stream, and whether or not they might give you problems with attribution. Attribution of contaminants back to your particular site. Here's a case that's not quite so simple. In this case, our 50-mile TDL does not end in a river. It ends in a lake. And when that occurs, what you do is you count the distance that of your in-water segment. So in this case, it's 14 miles until it hits this lake. And then you would go into the lake 1 mile, because that's what you have left to do your 15-mile TDL, and you would draw an arc around this 1 mile. And then any targets that are touching up against this particular area in Big Lake would be targets you would associate with your particular site. The HRS guidance has a lot of other scenarios for how to draw, how to locate your PPE, and how to calculate your 15-mile TDL correctly. So I would have you take a look at that if you find a weird situation that doesn't fall into these rather simple two that we've presented. So in the likelihood of release, that's the thing you usually would evaluate first when you're going through your preliminary scoring. You're either going to say that you have an observed release, and that could be by direct observation. Let's say you have a pipe that's discharging something from a source, or an obvious ditch that is discharging, or you might have an indication from historical records of flooding or some other type of release to a surface water body. So that would be by direct observation. And then at the PA stage, you're also just using your best professional judgment, combining what you know about the site and the source characteristics to determine how comfortable you are with saying that there may be an observed release. Other than that, you are relying on sampling data. And remember, when you're doing your PA and about to head into your site inspection, you have a lot of options for sampling in the surface water pathway. You can sample an aqueous sample or the surface water itself. You can sample the sediment. And you can also sample sessile benthic organisms, or SBOs. So these are the benthic organisms that don't move around very much. If you don't have any sampling data, then you're looking at the potential to release, and that takes into account both overland flow and flooding, and we'll show you how to do that when we get to QuickScore. Here's some of the factors that you're going to be looking at. So containment. Remember, we looked at containment when we did potential to release for the groundwater pathway. You're going to look at runoff, and that takes into account soil type, rainfall amount, and the drainage area size. And then the distance from sources to surface water. So that looks at the overland component. And then the flood component looks at flood frequency, essentially where your sources are, what floodplain they might lie in. And then you're going to evaluate those three threats. So drinking water looks at who or what is using the surface water, either for a drinking water source or for resources. And resources include watering livestock, watering a certain amount, 5 acres of crops. Could be used in food production, actually, too. The human food chain threat evaluates the human consumption of affected fish and other aquatic organisms that are taken from within fisheries identified in your target distance limit. And then the environmental threat looks at sensitive environments, and it's going to look at two, the wetland sensitive environment and then the sensitive environments from the list in table 4-23. Waste characteristics gives you a little, is a little different here in the surface water pathway. And it's the same as all the other ones in the drinking water threat. So in the drinking water threat, you're looking at your hazardous waste quantity, or HQ, hazardous quantity, and you're evaluating the toxicity and persistence of the contaminants associated with the sources. For the human food chain threat, we're looking at both the hazardous waste quantity, toxicity, persistence, and then we throw another factor in here, which is the bioaccumulation potential factor value. I think I've used the acronym. It's called BPSV, bioaccumulation potential factor value. And because we're adding a whole other thing in here, that means that in the surface water pathway for the human food chain threat, you can get a maximum waste characteristic score of 1,000. In most of the other pathways, you can only get a score of 100. So when you can get a maximum value in WC of 1,000, that just changes the math. You don't need as many targets in order to get that pathway score up to the minimum of 57 to score the site on just that one surface water pathway. So that's a big advantage for both the human food chain threat and the environmental threat, because the same thing happens here. We do HQ with toxicity persistence and then bioaccumulation. And this is ecotoxicity, ecopersistence, and ecobioaccumulation. And then and Sandra will go through and show you how that works when you're scoring. All these values that I'm talking about, toxicity, persistence, bioaccumulation, potential factor value, are pulled right out of SCIM. So here's some of the information that you should be obtaining when you're doing your preliminary assessment and you're trying to figure out what your preliminary HRS score will be. You'll want to identify all surface water intakes in the TDL and then determine the service connections for those for the system that is distributing that surface water as drinking water, and obtain the average number of people served by that by those connections, so you can get a population. If your system that is distributing the water is a blended system using more than one intake or blending water from intakes and groundwater wells, then you would need to do that apportioning, and the 40% rule would come into play here. And then finally, you can get a few points if you can identify resources associated with surface water. Now you can see the list of things that count. And then as you're collecting information in the PA and in the site inspection, you really need to determine and obtain your water flow information at the intake. So you must know in cubic feet per second the estimated flow. And whenever that flow changes, you need to figure out what the new flow is. For the human food chain threat, you would be looking, first of all, you need to be able to say that your eligible surface water bodies are fisheries. So you need to identify them as a place where people fish. They catch these food chain organisms, and then they consume them. And in the past, well, probably 10 years, documentation requirements for proving that up have become a little more stringent, so that EPA can really say in its HRS packages that there are folks that are catching this fish and there are folks that are consuming these fish. And then for each fishery, you need to identify its flow characteristics in cubic feet per second, and you need to estimate the fish production in pounds per year annually produced from that fishery. For the environmental threat, you're going to be collecting information, and it really is assessing the terrestrial and aquatic resources associated with your site. It gives special consideration for fragile natural settings as identified by the sensitive environments that are evaluated. The most common type of sensitive environment we evaluate in environmental threat is the wetland. And it is very important that you measure the frontage of your wetlands. You need to know that in order to generate a score. And then also become familiar with Table 4-23, which is where you find the list of other sensitive environments besides wetlands that will generate points for the site score. All right. So we're going to jump into what it would look like when we score our ABC vacuum site in QuickScore. And we're just going to work here from our screenshots. We are not going to try to do screen sharing. So the first thing you would do is you would select the pathway score sheets, and then you would select the surface water score sheet tab. So here is where you would go for the pathway score sheets, and then here's where you would select the surface water score sheet tab, and then it would look something like this. So the first thing you would note is that you see the two components, the ways that you can score the surface water migration pathway. This side is pointing to the surface water to the overland and flood component, and then over here we have groundwater to surface water component. Before proceeding in QuickScore, you have to name the watershed that is required in this box right here. And once you fill that name in, then everything comes live and you can start inputting data into these other boxes. QuickScore does allow you to evaluate multiple watersheds for a single site and then decide which watershed to use for the actual scoring. So the first thing we look at, and then just one more thing I'm going to show you, is right down here is our three threats. So when you click this tab, you're looking at drinking water. Here we'll look at human food chain, and here we're going to look at the environmental threat. The stuff we're going to do up here for now is going to be our observe release and potential to release. So the first thing we need to think about is how we would feel about scoring observed release for our ABC vacuum site. So let's take a look at a few site facts. We took this right out of that PA level information that we've provided to you. We have our runoff that is channeled sort of around the facility into intermittent ditches, and they collect the runoff from the site. This intermittent ditch forms into one ditch and flows about 6,000 feet or 1.1 miles into a perennial ditch. That perennial ditch then flows about 3 miles into a surface water body that looks like a stream called the bayou. And then some distance down, that bayou runs into a river at about 10 miles down. The estimated flow rates in the bayou is 15 cubic feet per second, and in the river it's 75 cubic feet per second. A little more site information. We know and have been told in the PA level information that the bayou and the river are used for fishing and swimming. We have also noted that there are no surface water intakes within our 15-mile target distance limit. The following sensitive environments were identified. There's a critical habitat for a federally designated and endangered species that's located 14 miles downriver from our PPE. But you should know that that gets 100 points from that table 4-23. There's also a wetland located quite far down. It's a 5-acre wetland, and it has a frontage of 0.4 miles. The site information told you that the site lies in the 500-year floodplain, and the drainage basin for the site is about 165 acres. That was measured during the PA. So I have a participant poll here. I'm not sure I saw that on the list. But if you want to try to bring it up, Mike, we can. If not, I will just talk them through it. I'm just going to talk you through this one. So this is really important. You need to draw this sort of map for your site and decide where these very important things lie. So what I did is I put in A, B, C, D, and E, and asked you to figure out where 1, 2, 3, and 4 go in the A, B, C, and D. So you can see A is located right here, and this is where the site dumps into the intermittent ditch. B is that stretch of intermittent ditch, which leads to the perennial ditch. The perennial ditch runs from here to the bayou, and then the bayou runs down here, joins with the river until we get down here to our dotted line. So let's talk about what each of these is. Now, the point A is really nothing, right, because it's where our site is discharging into our intermittent ditch. And we're in Louisiana, so we are not in an arid area, and so that word intermittent ditch should really cause your eyebrows to raise a little bit, because it is not an eligible surface water body when you're in for HRS when you're in the state of Louisiana. So A is really nothing in terms of any of our little labels here, but B is something. B becomes essentially our overland segment. Because it is how the hazardous substances are traveling through that intermittent ditch to this perennial ditch. And what C becomes is our probable point of entry. So C would be our PPE. And then we have our in-water segment that starts at the PPE and goes all the way down to E. So D would be our in-water segment, and E would be our TDL, our 15-mile TDL. All right. So after seeing where those labels are on the map, you should be thinking about how the surface water pathway is playing out. These are the things that I identified that raise questions in my mind about the ABC vacuum site. First of all, the distance from the sources to the PPE. there is this intermittent ditch that is not an eligible surface water body, and so there's quite a distance between the sources, where the sources are, and where the PPE is at this particular site. You also want to look at the migration potential of the contaminants at the site, and their migration potential in surface water. Are they the types of contaminants that would go a long way in surface water, or do they like to stay cling on to sediments and not go very far? I think you also would have to look at potential attribution issues. And that just means anytime you have some other thing kind of coming into your surface water body, you have the potential for folks to question, you know, is the contamination coming from your site or is it being attributed by another facility on this other water body? So you have attributions here. You have another, looks like perennial ditch or maybe a branch of the bayou that's coming in here. So if you had an industrial facility contributing contaminants, you know, you'd have attribution questions. You have it here where this, you have these two water bodies coming together, and then once again, you have something else coming in to your surface water body here. So there are reasons to think attribution could be a potential issue. And then finally, there's quite a distance now from your site to your environmental receptors, the sorts of things you'd evaluate in the environmental threat. You have your wetland, which is quite far down here, and then this endangered species habitat, which is down near the end of your 15-mile TDL. So those are things to think about. But since we like to do worst case, we went ahead and said 550, but we would have made a lot of notes, maybe on our scratch pad or in the notes that we keep as we do this type of work, about all the things that make us uncertain about that, about assigning a 550. All right, now we're going to just keep on going and look at the potential to release. It does have two components, overland flow component, so you're looking at containment runoff and distance to surface water, and then the flood component, looking at containment and flood frequency. So the first thing you would do is click here to pull up the appropriate part of the HRS rule just to see the instructions for scoring this. And then your choices for containment are to choose one of these values from this drop-down list. And this works the same way that it did with groundwater. You have another containment table in HRS. It's table 4-2, and we've included that in the manual itself so you could take a look at it. And for each source type, they give a description of the type of containment or lack of containment you might see. You read those descriptions, and if your sources fall into one of the descriptive categories, you would assign it the point value that goes with that description. And the point values you can see are 10, 9, 7, 5, 3, and 0. Now, we know that at ABC Vacuum, we already have evidence of hazardous substance migration from the lagoon to the ditches. And so we're going to make a leap here and say that containment score is the maximum score you can get, and we would have assigned it a value of 10. So we pick our 10, and then we move on to our runoff component. So right here is our 10, and now we're going to talk about runoff. So runoff is a little more complicated. It is assigned, you assign a value after you do some work by pulling factor values out and figuring out the factor value associated with the drainage area, the soil group, and the 2-year, 24-hour rainfall. And we'll show you how that's done. So for, this is a definite poll if you want to bring it up, Mike, and if it doesn't come up quick, I'll just go through it. Okay, here we go. So here's where we, table 4-3, this is from the HRS rule, is where you pull out the value for drainage area. So it's very simple. ABC Vacuum has 165-acre drainage area. What value would you assign it from the table? All right. Most of you are getting it right there. This is a softball question. I wanted to start out a little easier. So we can see we fit right in here in the, come on, little green guy, 50 to 100 to 250 foot line, which gives us a value of 2. You could just note that or jot that down because you're going to use that 2 value a little bit later. So you can close that poll. Great. All right, next you have to decide what its soil, what the soil group designation is for the surface soils located at your site. And so we have table 4-4 that gives us a description of what the what values you can assign, A, B, C, D. Here are the descriptions over here. So let's look at what we have at our site. This is a description about the hydrogeologic and geologic setting. And as you can see, it seems like we have pretty permeable soils around here, mainly sands, a little bit of silty sand, some gravel. And so going back to that table, and here's our cross-section. Now, this is mainly the subsurface, but you can see up here at the surface, we mainly have sand. All right, so we got another poll. Again, this should be a pretty easy one. So based on what you know about the soil at ABC Vacuum, what letter would you give it? All right, most of you are getting that one right. For the folks that are voting for B, C, and D, I'm very sorry. We do believe this one is an A. So A, where you have a lot of sand and maybe a bit of loamy sand, kind of high infiltration rates. So we said, you can close this poll, Mike. Thank you. And we said, I think I have a little. Yeah, we said A. So remember that one. Now, the next thing you need to find is the estimated 2-year, 24-hour rainfall. You can get this from existing sources on the Internet. So that's all we did. We found a map that gave us the 2-year precipitation accumulation and 2-year recurrence interval for the area of the United States we were interested in. Remember, we are in Louisiana. And so you can see, I think this is Louisiana right here. And the values that we see range from 4.5 to 6. So taking that value, you would bring it to this particular table here and combine the soil group designation, which was A, with our 2-year 24-hour rainfall, which is 3.5, and voila, I think I got a little animation here. So 3.5 was our, we are greater than that because we were between 4.5 and 6 on our map. We were soil group designation A, so voila, we get a 3 for our rainfall runoff value. Then we go to another table, which is table 4-6. We take the rainfall runoff value that we just figured out, which was 3. We take that drainage area value that we did earlier. That was a 2. You'll have to trust me on that. And you see where they meet. And we did all that hard work for a grand value of 1. So we would then go back to our drop-down menu and select that 1. So if you're scoring on potential, there's a bit of work you need to do before you can actually select the value from this drop-down menu. All right, so next we would, we're going to do distance to surface water. And in order to do that, you need to figure out the distance between your sources and your PPE and then take that to another table, which is table 4-7 in the HRS rule. Now, we already know that we have about 6,000 feet or 1.1 miles between our sources and our PPE. And that is because we cannot count that intermittent ditch as a surface water body. So we got a long way our hazardous substances have to travel before they reach our PPE. And if you look at our table, we would fall here in this row. And so for ABC vacuum, we would assign a value of 6. And we would put it right here in this box. All right, next we're going to look at flooding. And it's going to take us over to this part of the top of that page. All right, so we have another drop-down value, and you get to choose either 0 or 10. And the way to decide that is to go to Table 4-8 in the HRS rule, and you can see you either get 10 points or you get 0 points. And the 0 is really when you have really good containment. So if you look at all of those descriptions there, you can see that, you know, these particular sources would need to be very well contained in order to get a 0. Otherwise, you get a 10. So we thought that 10 was probably the best answer here. You know, we do not have perfectly contained sources. And you get to use the source that gives you the worst value here. So you would, so at ABC, we look at all 6 sources and give the one that gives the worst value or the highest value. So we selected 10 and put that in there. And then the last thing we need to do is look at flood frequency. And that's from a drop-down value. And you get the value you select by looking at where what your sources are, what floodplain they are located in. And we were told that our whole site and all the sources in it are in the 500-year floodplain. That gives us this value here of 7. So we would take that and select that in the drop-down value. The drop-down menu. So now you can see the program has calculated our potential to release score at a whopping 140, which is very low. That you would not be jumping up and down about getting a 140 in potential to release. But the factors that made the potential to release in groundwater really high, if you recall, we were at a 460. And that's just 40 points shy of the maximum. So the same things that made the groundwater value high have made our surface water value low. And that makes sense intuitively. So we don't have really tight soils. When stuff falls on the ground in this particular part of Louisiana, it's more likely to infiltrate than it is to run off. And that's reflected in the 2 scores. And the distance through our surface water and our PPE also played a role. All right, we're not going to stop for questions yet. We're going to keep going. And we're going to look at the drinking water threat. So the first thing you do here is you want to assign persistence so that the QuickScore program can figure out which contaminant to use to calculate the WC. When you click that Assign Persistence button, you'll get a new window that comes up, and you'll see all of those contaminants listed that you had selected back when you input the sources into the source information into QuickScore. Now all you need to do is for each hazardous substance, you would highlight it. You would say that you either have a predominant water body category of lake or river. At ABC vacuum, it's a river system. So we would select river, and we would, after we had selected all of our substances, we would then hit save and return to the score sheet. And what the QuickScore program will do is it'll select the substance that gives you the highest combined score for toxicity persistence, toxicity and persistence. We're in the drinking water category. And in this case, it's arsenic. What the program does is if you have substances that give you a tie, so the score is the same, it picks the one with the goes in alphabetical order, essentially, to select and pick it. So if you look back at that table, there were several substances that gave you a 10,000. And our WC for turns into a 32. And that's a little higher than the WC that we had in groundwater. I recall that being an 18. So for the drinking water threat, we did have a higher toxicity and persistent contaminant that played a role in giving us a higher WC. For the drinking water threat, you can only get 100 in WC. Now let's look at our targets. So, question, participant poll, are there any surface water intakes in the TDL at ABC Vacuum? I must have been feeling very nice when I was putting these questions together, because I think this is the easy one, too. It's Friendly Friday. All right, you're mostly getting it right, except for a few of you in the yes category. So remember, it has to be a surface water intake that, you know, is it's usually associated with some sort of municipal system. And the PA noted that we did not have any surface water intakes. So the correct answer is no for this one. You can close that. Perfect. We'll keep on going. So when we pull up our nearest intake factor value, which is the first thing you score in targets, we would select zero because we have no intakes. So you can see our nearest intake is zero. And then if we don't have any intakes, we can't have any population associated with those intakes. So both our level 1 population, our level 2 population, and our potential population would be a zero. Now, at this point, hopefully you're thinking, this is not looking so good for the drinking water threat, and you would be right. If you don't have intakes, you probably won't score the drinking water threat, and you'll just note in the documentation that there are no intakes, and therefore, you know, you didn't do much for this particular threat. I would even question whether or not you'd want to chase a lot of information or even assign a value for resources, because that itsy-bitsy 5 points is going to make no difference at all. This is what you look at to assign whether or not you get those 5 points for resources. And this table came out of the HRS guidance. For our sake, we just said zero. Since we have a big zero in our population, it just doesn't make much sense to spend much time here. So our drinking water threat is zero, and we would then move on to the human food chain threat. And now I guess we will take a few questions, Mike, and then we'll hand it off to Sandra.
Thank you, Therese. I tried to note where some of these came in as far as slides go, but I wasn't able to get all of them. We did have one early on. Question is, would the headworks of a bayou be considered perennial?
The headworks of a bayou? I'm not sure.
Oh, what,
it has to be
waters? Maybe the headwaters?
As long as they are perennially flowing, then they would be. So as long as they always have water.
Okay.
And don't dry up part of the year.
Okay. I think the next two came in about slide 22/24 when you had the drawing up.
Okay.
And so this is referring to that because you had a point D on there.
Yes.
The question is, was point D a PPE to the river?
No, because you want to, the river is too far down gradient to be considered a PPE, and you have an eligible surface water body before that. So you want to pick the surface water bodies that are closest, and it's the first point at which your hazardous substances reach an eligible surface water body. So even though that's part D, would have been defined as the in-water segment. And that if the whole, you know, it goes from the PPE all the way down to the 15-mile TDL.
Okay. And then the next question is, apparently referring to those drawings, is this called a conceptual site model?
It's the very beginnings of one. So a conceptual site model really is what you think is going on at the site, where contaminants are, where they're migrating to, and who they're affecting. And a map of that is one way to display a conceptual site model. So that's a piece of a conceptual site model.
Okay, and I think there's also a question here regarding some map that you might have put up. And actually the question is, I think they're asking, what does the acronym USGS stand for? I believe that's the question.
Yeah, that stands for the U.S. Geological Survey, which is a federal government entity that does a lot of environmental work, actually.
Okay. And I think this goes to about slide 47-ish. Are storm sewers considered to be intermittent ditches?
Sandra, what do you?
Oh, wow, that's a good question. I think this one comes up every now and then.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, I think it all depends. Storm sewers, sometimes they could be part of the overland path. You would have to have documentation showing that they have water in them all the time. And it would be one of those special cases, similar to how you have the arid areas for intermittent streams. And I think if you have a site where you might want to consider a storm sewer, you would definitely need to discuss that with the NPL coordinator to make sure that, you know, it's going to be accepted. But, you know, it's one of those areas where, you know, it's a gray area and you're going to have a lot of attribution issues because a lot of other discharges are going to be entering that storm sewer. And if there's contamination in your surface water, then you would not be able to prove definitively that it did come from your site.
Okay. Okay, so the next question gets back to the soil numerals. When I say A and D here, they're not talking about the points on the map. They're talking about the soil. So should a high soil value such as A instead be entered as D if a substantial proportion of the site is impervious?
So if a substantial portion of the site were like with concrete or asphalt or something like that,
I
think you really do have to look at the soil type. I don't, in that table, I only see soil types there. I don't see concrete. So you have to decide.
And I believe, I'm sorry, go ahead,
Sandra. No, go ahead, Sandra.
That refers to the soils where the hazardous substance would travel overland because the soil type is the potential to release for overland flow. So you would have to use a predominant type that where the hazardous substances would flow over.
Okay, and I have a clarification on the USGS question. The question was asking if you got the precipitation and flood data from the USGS.
No, that was a different source. I believe it was a regional source from that area. I just Googled 2-year 24-hour rainfall, and I found it very quickly.
That's all the questions I have for now.
All right. And Sandra, you can take over.
Okay, so we talked about the general considerations for the surface water migration pathway, and we went through the drinking water threat. As we go to the human food chain and environmental threat, you will notice that there are some things that carry over. So let's see, for the human food chain. So basically, when we look at the quick score in human food chain, we can already see that our likelihood of release, observed release, is already there. And the information that we entered when we were looking at whether or not we would do potential, that's still there. So now we're going to start a human food chain threat, and we're going to click on the tab that you see here for human food chain threat. And the first thing that we do is we assign the hazardous substances that we're going to use for our waste characteristics. Because after we do likelihood of release, the first thing we will try to calculate is our waste characteristics. So we would click on the tab, and it's going to pull up a box just like what we saw before when Therese was doing the drinking water threat. So we look at the hazardous substances, and we enter them into the human food chain threat. We have to select whether or not our surface water body is a river or lake, and then whether or not the water type is salt water or fresh water. And whenever you're doing a site score, you know, you want to try to save time as much as possible. So one of the things that I usually do when I'm scoring a site, I will pick the substance that I know is going to give you the highest values. And as you score sites, the more and more you score sites, you're going to become more and more familiar with the different hazardous substances. And you will have an idea of which ones are going to give you what type of numbers for the different threats that you're scoring. So basically, we noticed that benzoylpyrene gives us the highest value. When we did drinking water, we had arsenic in there because Therese mentioned that the substances that have an equal number, the system more or less picks the one in alphabetical order and puts that one in there for you. So for the human food chain, we're going to select benzoylpyrene because it's going to give us the highest value. And we're going to ensure this, you know, when we click on the tab, we're going to click on save and return to the score sheets right here. And when we go to our score sheet, we want to make sure that it's telling us that benzoylpyrene is, has been selected as a substance to use. Because there is a place that tells us, it has a place that tells us some substance to use in there. So this is the same slide that shows us where we need to click on save and return to the score sheets right here. So we're going to go to the next page, and right here is where I was talking about where it tells us the substance to use. It usually has the name of the substance in this particular area. So we can see that benzoylpyrene has a 10,000 for toxicity and then a 50,000 for bioaccumulation potential. And the system is going to calculate what the waste characteristics is for us automatically. So when we're at this step, we want to make sure that the substance that gives us the highest values combination, and it's not just to say like, okay, arsenic is going to give us the highest toxicity and benzoylpyrene will give us the highest bioaccumulation factor value. We have to select the substance that gives us the combined highest value because you can't pick and choose like a la carte like what you would do at a restaurant. You want to make sure that whatever substance you selected, the highest value in the end is what you want to use. Okay, so basically now our waste characteristics is scored for us, and we see we've got a WC of 320. A WC of 320 is very common for the surface water migration pathway, the human food chain threat. The more and more you score size, you will see that this is a very common number. Usually if you have a waste quantity of a 100 and you have something like benzoylpyrene, you tend to get a 320 for your human food chain. So basically the system calculates this number for us. So we're going to move on to the next slide. And we're going to talk about food chain individual. Food chain individual is one of those factors that we score in the human food chain threat. And as we go through the different pathways, we're going to see particular factors in the HRS model that are very similar to something else in a different pathway. So food chain individual in this particular threat is very similar to nearest intake, and it is similar to nearest well in your groundwater migration pathway. So food chain individual evaluates whether or not there's a fishery within a target distance limit. And if there is a fishery within a target distance limit, is it subject to actual contamination or is there an observed release to that particular surface water body? But maybe there might be a fishery somewhere downstream within our 15-mile TDL, and whether or not we are going to evaluate our surface water body or fishery as potential contamination. Okay, So basically, we've got a participant poll here, and we will go ahead and walk through the poll. So we talked about the different segments of our surface water migration path. We know this is an intermittent ditch that goes into perennial ditch, and then we've got the bayou, which goes into the river downstream. So based on the surface water bodies that we have in our area, as we go out and we do our site assessment work, we need to figure out what types of targets we're going to be evaluating. So can we evaluate the intermittent stream as a fishery? What about the perennial ditch, the bayou, and the river? So based on our site information, we're going to pull from our site information and see what we can evaluate as fisheries. Based on the HRS rule, we can't evaluate the intermittent ditch as a fishery because we're in Louisiana. We're not in an area where we can evaluate an intermittent stream as perennial surface water because it's not arid. So we know this one's out. The perennial ditch, we have to draw from our soil information. It is perennial. That means there is a possibility, but our soil information does not give us any information about whether or not a perennial ditch is a fishery. So if you have a situation like this where there's a perennial ditch, you would want to go out while you're out there doing your site reconnaissance, you're doing your sampling, you may want to talk to local residents and ask them, you know, okay, does it really have water in it year-round? You know, does it usually ever have any fish in there? Do people catch the fish in there? Do they eat the fish? Those types of things. Because sometimes our soil information might tell us, you know what, the perennial ditch is not a fishery or there's no documented fishing in that particular water body. But information that you gather might be able to prove otherwise. So while you're out in the field, it's always good to ask those types of questions. And also you want to make your own observations because, I mean, you're sampling, so you want to see and document whether or not you noted any fish in there, you know, anything that people might possibly catch and eat. Okay, our soil information does tell us that the bayou is a fishery as well as the river is also a fishery. So we have that information documented in our PA report. So we can go ahead and evaluate the bayou and the river as fisheries. And basically this slide more or less explains what we talked about when we looked at the map as far as which particular surface water bodies that we can evaluate as fisheries for our scoring model. Okay, so food chain individual, actual food chain. So there are different ways in which we can document whether or not we have actual contamination. Some of the ways are a little bit harder than others. Some are more common. So we're going to go through and look at what we need to do to document that we've got actual contamination in a particular fishery. So with actual contamination, the first thing we have to do is document observed release. So now we've got an observed release of a hazardous substance in our surface water body, and we know it's a fishery. So for the human food chain threat, there's something else that we have to look at. Whether or not the hazardous substance that we're evaluating has a bioaccumulation potential factor value of 500 or greater. So let's say, for instance, if that bioaccumulation value is 50, then we can't document actual contamination because we have to show that that particular hazardous substance is going to bioaccumulate in the particular fish or clams or mussels, the types of organisms that people will catch and eat. So in that way, it's going to have some sort of effect on them. So it has to be 500 or greater present in observed release, or if we had direct observation. If we have direct observation, we're going to have to document that particular observation was noted somewhere within the fishery that we're evaluating. And also, if we have a surface water or sediment sample that is collected within the fishery and the hazardous substance that we're looking at has a BCF factor value of 500 or greater, so we can actually document actual contamination in a fishery that way. We're going to look at what types of samples that we need to evaluate level 1 and level 2, because whenever we hear actual, we always know that level 1 and level 2 is coming next. Okay, so now we've got another way that we can document actual contamination is whether or not we have a closed fishery. This is similar to where you have a drinking water well that was closed due to contamination. So if we have a fishery that was closed due to contamination, we can still count and score that particular surface water body as a fishery. In order to do that, we would have to have a sample collected during a time when that particular surface water body was being used as a fishery and the hazardous substance had a BCS greater than 500, it met observed release, and we can say, even if it is now closed, we can say, okay, we did collect a sample, it was contaminated, and because of the results of that sample, we had to close the fishery due to contamination. Another type of sample that we can use would be essentially sessile benthic human food chain organisms, things like mussels and clams, those types of things that don't move around frequently. They are more or less in that localized area of where you caught that particular species. We can use those types of samples to document and observe release. And if it's within our fishery, the location that you collected that particular tissue sample is within our fishery, then we can say, okay, we've got actual contamination, and then we're going to look at whether or not it's level one and level two. Okay, so basically, this is a site information for ABC. We know we've got our likelihood of release. We have our PPE is about 1.1 miles from the site. That's just a little ways down. And our closest fishery is 4.1 miles. That's, you know, very far. In order for us to document a fishery that far downstream, we would have to have a lot of samples because, I mean, that's a pretty good distance, and it's possible that we can have other facilities that have contributed contamination to that surface water body. So we're going to need a lot of documentation to be able to say we have an observed release to our fishery and it's actually contaminated all the way down to 4.1 miles. Okay, so basically these are the things that we use to evaluate actual contamination, the BCFV of 500 or greater, observed release, whether or not we've got fisheries that are closed due to contamination, and also about the tissue samples. And if we don't have those, then we're going to have to evaluate potential to release. So we're going to look at what values we're going to assign for our food chain individual. And that is similar to our nearest well and our nearest intake. Okay, so in the HRS rule section 4.1.3.3.1, you know, it tells us that we can evaluate food chain individual and assign points for level one and level two. So if we have a concentration in a tissue sample or in a surface water sample and it's above a particular benchmark, then we can assign level one for our fishery. If we don't have a tissue sample, then we can assign level two using and assign 45 points for level two. Usually whenever we score the surface water pathway, the most common types of samples that we have are sediment samples, and we will use those to score our food chain individual and assign 45 points from level two. So if we don't have level one and level two, and there's an observed release to Peruvian surface water with a fishery downstream, we can assign 20 points for our food chain individual. So basically that tells us that we've got an observed release to Peruvian surface water. We know that there's a fishery that can be impacted within a target distance limit that is within 15 miles, so we can assign 20 points for our food chain individual. Okay. And if we don't have observed release, or if, for instance, our BCF factor is less than 500, then we are going to have to evaluate potential. But we'll talk about potential a little bit further down. Okay. So level one is very hard to establish because of the types of samples that we need to be able to establish level one. Generally, you would need to have a surface water sample, or you need to have a tissue sample, like we mentioned. We most of the time have sediment samples, and that's what we would use to evaluate level two. So we basically would just go right on to the level two if we know for sure that we've got sediment samples that are, you know, above our that meet observed release, and we have hazardous substances with a BCF factor value of 500 or greater, or if we have observed release to a perennial surface water or fishery downstream. Okay, so we're going to look at the quick score. Let's see, where's my little arrow? I don't see. Okay, So if we have a first car on our site and we don't have level one or level two because we have no samples or our samples did not meet observed release within the fishery, because in order for us to score that fishery, we have to have those samples within the fishery. And remember, for our site, we didn't have the fishery until 4.1 miles downstream. So we have observed release to perennial surface water with a fishery downstream. So we're going to go ahead and assign 20 points right here. I can get my little arrow to come up. So we're going to assign 20 points. That's in the middle of the screen where you see the red box. And that's going to be our food chain individual. And we can see what that is going to do for our site score. Basically, we've got a 22.63 at this particular time. Okay, so actual contamination. When we have level one and level two, we first have to assign the food chain individual factor value. So we get a 45 points, the 50 points, or the 20 points. And then we have to figure out how much fish is caught within that fishery on an annual basis. So we've got to figure out the production of fish per year. If when we have that number, we multiply by 10, just like we do for the other level one factors in a different pathway. Whenever you have level one population, you multiply by 10. If we have level two, we just multiply by the 1. And we assign that as our population value. So we're going to take a look and see where we get the population values. They come from table 4-8 from the HRS rule. And you can see the numbers that we have to document in order to be able to get go from one breaking point to the other. So let's say, for instance, that we have a very small stream and we have 10,000 pounds of fish caught per year. We get 3 points for that. So in order for us to go from 3 to 31, we would have to document at least 100,000 pounds of fish per year. Generally, the pounds of fish per year for your particular surface water body is usually very hard to document. A lot of times you don't have that data available to you. So you can go ahead and estimate that I know for sure that people are fishing from my surface water body and they're catching at least 1 pound of fish. So that means it's greater than zero. So we're going to say greater than zero, and we can assign the lowest number, which is 0.3, is what you would do if you don't have any data documenting what those pounds are. But our final information did give us some data on pounds of fishery, so we're going to look at what we have for our ABC side. So we know that the bayou is about 100 to 1,000 pounds, and we get a 0.3 for that. So the river has between 1,000 and 10,000 pounds, and we get a 3 for that. So if we have level one, we're going to sum the two values, so we have 3.3, and we multiply by 10, so we get 30. So that's a pretty good point value for level one. And if we have a level two, we get the same 3.3, we multiply only by 1, and we round to 3. So we get a 3. So you can see the difference between level one and level two. You know, it's a good difference between those two, because sometimes if you have 30 points for certain things for targets versus 3 points, that can make a difference in your pathway score and also your site score. So this slide shows us the in the red box, it shows us the different the multipliers that we use when we have level one or level two concentrations for actual contamination. You basically take your population and you multiply by 10 for level one, and for level two you multiply your population by 1. And this similar issue is going to be the same thing for basically all of the pathways that you evaluate. Generally, you always multiply level 1 by 10 and level 2 by 1. Okay, and once we enter the information in, it tabulates what the score is for our target value, and we can see down here that right now we've got 23 points. Okay. So basically, just to wrap up the level one and level two actual contamination, we know that level one is very hard to document because of the types of samples that we have to use for level one. And then we have a fishery that is pretty far downstream from the site. We're assuming that we can possibly have a level two Because, okay, 4.1 miles, that's a good little distance, but if we have a sediment sample, we could possibly document, you know, we have a level 2 maybe in the bayou. You know, the bayou is about 1.1 miles away, so that's not too bad. But 4.1 miles, that's a pretty good distance. We would have a lot of issues with attribution trying to score that. So to be conservative, we're going to go with the bayou, and we're going to select the 0.3 from table 4-8 for our population for level 2 contamination. So we enter that in our score sheets. We enter it into quick score right here. So we put in the 0 for level 1 and 0.3 for level 2 in the red boxes, as you can see on the screen. Okay, so now we have potential. We talked about level 1, we talked about level 2. So if we don't have level 1 or level 2, then we're going to have to evaluate potential contamination. Okay, so in order for us to do potential contamination, we're going to get the population from table 4-18 like we did before. Whenever we do potential, we know that there's some sort of distance weighting that we're going to have to apply to our population values. When we did groundwater, there was a table and we had assigned numbers. So in this case, for surface water pathway, we're going to apply a dilution weight, just like we did in the drinking water threat. And then after we apply the dilution weight to our for our food chain, for our human food chain value, we also need to divide by 10, because basically whenever you're doing potential, you more or less have to divide by 10. And the point value that you get for potential is, you know, once you do that two times, you're multiplying by two different things, then your score always ends up being very low. Okay, so let's say, for instance, we're looking at the river. So the river has a 75 cubic feet per second, and if we look in table 4-13, the dilution weight is 0.1. That's not too bad. And then if we look at the table 4-13, we can see this as we've got a small stream, and we see where the flow rate falls between 10 and 100. So that's where we get the 0.1 from. It comes from out of the HRS rules. Okay, so for that particular surface water body, the bayou, we know we have between 1,000 and 10,000 pounds. So we're going to get the value at, I'm sorry, this is for the river. So we've got 1,000 to 10,000 pounds per year fish caught. We're going to get the value from the table, which is 3. And we're going to put those two together with our dilution factor, and we're going to see what that's going to end up doing. So basically, this is table 4-18, and you can see in the red box we get a 3 because of the range of the values that we have for our pounds of fish caught from that particular surface water body per year. Okay, so we're looking at a human food chain value, and we can see that if we have a 3 for a human food chain, and then we apply the dilution weight, which is 0.1, and then we get a 0.3 for our human food chain value here. But then we have to divide by 10. So that means your number is going to go down even further. You're going to have 0.03 for your potential population for the human food chain threat. So when we go back to quick score, we can see that we have a 0.3, we enter it in, and the software does the calculations for us and multiplies it by the 0.1, and then we get a point. Basically, it's adding everything up in the box right here for us. It puts in the value for the potential, and then we've got a target value down in the middle of the red box. Okay, so we can say based on the human food chain threat score, and what we currently have for our drinking water threat, the human food chain now has a threat score of 43.37, and why do we have a 100 here? Okay, so we're going to look at the human food chain threat score right now as being 43.33. I think right now we have everything already entered, and that's the reason why we're seeing a 100 towards the left of that. Okay, so we're going to look at the environmental threat. So once we're finished calculating our human food chain threat score, we're going to click on the button that says environmental threat, and it's going to take us to the next section of our surface water pathway. We're going to take some questions at the end.
No, Sandra, I think we should just wait till the end.
Wait? Okay. We should wait for questions till the end, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right, so we're going to move on to the environmental threat. So we're finished with human food chain, and we clicked on to the – Mike, I can't get the green arrow anymore, and I'm not really sure why. Let's see. Can I get it now? Okay. So anyway, right in the middle of the screen, we have the three threats. So we click on environmental threat. We already have a likelihood of release that we calculated from our drinking water threat. It carried on down to our environmental threat. So the first thing that we need to do is figure out what type of substance we're going to use to calculate our waste characteristics. So now we need ecotoxicity persistence for our environmental threat. So let's see what substance we're going to use. So we're going to have to enter in all of our substances, and then their values are going to show up at the bottom in the box on the bottom. And for each substance, we're going to click whether or not we have fresh water and whether or not we're evaluating a river or a lake. So all of our substances, we're going to have to make sure we have those buttons. But to save time when you're scoring your site, once you're familiar with the types of substances that are going to yield the highest values, you can probably just go ahead and select that one. In that way, you can save time without having to enter every single one of those. But if you're not quite sure, then you would have to enter each one so you can see which one will have the highest combined value. Because it's not just the toxicity by itself. And in the environmental threat, you will see in the SCIDM database, we're going to move to ecotoxicity and also ecobioaccumulation for the environmental threat. So once we've added the substances or the substance that we would like to use for our environmental threat, we're going to click the Save and Return to the Score Sheets button. So we can see what substance that we picked, and we picked benzoylpyrene because we know it's going to give us the highest value. And benzoylpyrene and cadmium actually give us the same numbers in this particular scenario, but like we mentioned earlier, the system picks the one in alphabetical order whenever you have two different values or two or more values that have the same exact figure, numbers. So we have benzoylpyrene on our screen, and we know that we have a WC of 320. And you notice that the WC for environmental threat is the same thing that we have for human food chain. That is very common, but it's not always the same. So let's say if you were scoring a site manually, you would not automatically assign the WC that you use in human food chain for your environmental threat. You kind of have to go through the process for each of the different threats in the surface water pathway, because every now and then you might have a situation where your hazardous substance might have a lower ecotoxicity, or it might have a lower ecobioaccumulation, or lower or higher, I should actually say. The values may not always be the same. That's the point to more or less get across. So we always have to enter the substance for each one. And let's say, for instance, if the values were never different, I believe that QuickScore would skip this step for the environmental threat, because QuickScore helps us out by carrying the common things throughout the entire software program for all the different pathways and different factors that we need to calculate. But because it knows that sometimes the values are different, that's the reason why it's more or less forcing us to think about that. So that's why we have to click on that button and manually select the substance that's going to give us the highest value. Okay, so we're doing environmental threats. Our targets are different from human food chain. Now we're looking at wetlands, and we're looking at endangered and threatened species, different types of targets. So the two targets that our PA report told us that we have, our file information told us that we have for this particular site is wetlands. We have 0.4 miles of wetlands, and we're going to be trying to get a value. You always get some number of points. Whenever you do an HRS work, it's all about the points. So there's always some number of points we're going to assign. And for wetlands, we get those points from table 4-24. And when we do endangered or threatened species, we get those numbers from table 4-23 of the HRS rule. So our file information tells us that we've got a critical habitat for an endangered species. So we're going to see what point value do we get from that. Okay, so we have a poll.
And basically from our table that you can see on the screen, we know that our file information told us that we have 0.4 miles of wetland frontage. So now we need to figure out what point value are we going to assign. So if you would fill in the blanks, you can type your information in and see what point value that we're going to get for our environmental threats for the wetlands ratings. And we're getting some answers are being plugged in. And in the essence of time to make sure we're going to be able to finish the module and answer your question. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to end the poll. And basically, because we have 0.4 miles, we know that we're going to get 25 points for, oh, here's my arrow. We're going to get 25 points for wetland frontage. So let's say, for instance, if we were going to sample, we would want to make sure that if we have wetlands as a target that we're looking at along a surface water body, that we need to place our samples in a strategic location so that when we get to evaluate our wetlands, we will have enough points. So we will first determine how much frontage we have, and if we know for sure we have at least 0.1 of a mile, we've got more than that, we want to say, okay, well, where do I need to place my sample? So we're going to make sure that we place our sample at least 1/10 of a mile into the wetland to make sure that we get some points. Because if we have less than 1/10, you see you don't get any points. So it's all about points, so we want to make sure we can grab those points whenever we can. So for our wetland value, we get a 25 points. Now we're going to look at what point value did we get for our sensitive environment. We've got a critical habitat for federal designated endangered threatened species. So we're going to see what point value that we're going to get. And we can see that people have started answering, so you can type your answers in. And we actually have the answer on the screen. So we're going to just go ahead and move forward because we have the answer on the screen. So that one was super easy. That one was a freebie. So, but Teresa, today's Friday, so there's a lot of freebies today. So critical habitat, we get 100 points. And we get those values from table 4-23. In table 4-23, it lists out all the different sensitive environments that you can get points for. Because sometimes there are particular things that might be along your surface water pathway, and it might not really qualify. So whenever you know that you've got a particular thing, whether or not you've got a state or federally designated endangered or threatened species, you can look into table 4-23. It assigns the points for you. So basically, usually for state designated species, we get 50 points. For federal, we usually get 75. And critical habitat gets the highest number of points. 100 is the highest number of points that we can get. And in this table, it tells us all the different things that we can get 100 points for. So when you're looking at your surface water pathway environmental threat, table 4-23 is one of your best friends, really, because you get a lot of points if you can score those particular types of targets. Okay, so basically we're talking about level of contamination for environmental threat. So whenever we look at targets, we're always thinking, okay, what is that target? Is it contaminated? Is it not contaminated? And if it is contaminated, at what level? So targets, then we move on to level one, level two, you know, when we look at targets. So basically, we would have to document that somewhere within our surface water body, where we've got a sense of environment, we've got a direct observation showing that there's a release to that particular sense of environment, or we have a surface water sample, a benthic sample, or a sediment sample within the area of our sensitive environment, whether it's in the middle of the water body area or whether it's, you know, along the bank, you know. It basically has to be in that particular sensitive environment, or it has to be within your surface water where it's adjacent to your sensitive environment. So now we're going to see, based on our map of our site, so we can see that we've got our wetlands. And our wetlands are pretty far down, as well as our critical habitat. That's pretty far down as well, too. So if we have this particular site, you know, this particular scenario for our surface water pathway, it's going to be very hard to be able to document the wetlands and also the sensitive environment, because you know, it is so far down, you know, so there's going to be a lot of attribution issues. You will need a lot of samples to be able to say, okay, I know for sure it's coming from my side. So in this particular situation, I think it's going to be very hard to document, you know, whether or not a release from the site all the way up there is going to impact your endangered species habitat and whether or not it's definitely from your site. Okay. So when we talk about level one and level two, we know we've got some amount of point value. And if we have level one, we multiply by 10 as usual. And level two, we just take the number as is. So because we're evaluating two different kinds of targets for our environmental threat, we're going to add up those point values. So if we have wetlands and we also have sensitive environments, we're going to add those two up. Then we multiply by 10. So imagine we had a 100 for our sensitive environment, and we had 25 for the wetland value. So now we get to multiply that by 10. That's really awesome being able to do that, because all of a sudden those low point values just, you know, just multiply, and you know you're gonna get a lot of points for that. So if you have level two, then we would add the wetland frontage and also the sensitive environmental frontage, and potential. We always have to divide. We know that we have to apply distance weighting. So because this is a surface water pathway, we're going to take the sum of the environmental target's value plus the frontage of the wetlands value, and we're going to multiply by a dilution weight, and then we're going to divide by 10 again. So you know for sure by the time you do all of that, you're going to get a very low number for potential. So generally, whenever we get down to potential, we know for sure we're going to be coming down to some low points. So for our level one, so we would have a total of 125 points times 10. So imagine if you have 1,250 points for your targets. Because always remember, whenever you have targets, they're uncapped. So therefore, you have a chance to get a very high score if your sensitive targets are uncapped. So if, for instance, we know for sure we've got wetlands and we've got sensitive environments close to the site, then we want to make sure we try to sample those areas. But if they're very far away, it might be kind of hard to prove. So we can see a difference between 1,200, 125, and one measly point for potential. So anytime we can document the level one or the level two, we want to go for it. Okay, so we're going to look at quick score. And in quick score, in the box on the right-hand side, we can see where we're entering our values for our targets. So in this particular case, we're assuming that we've got level two contamination, and for the environmental threat score, we can only get a score of 60. The maximum score that we can get is 60. It's not like surface water or human food chain where we could have gotten a 100. So we can only get a 60 for the environmental threat. But as you can see in the box, it's possible when you multiply your likelihood of release, your targets, and your WC, and then you divide by 82.5, you know, it's possible to get a number that's higher than 100, but we have to cap that score. So we call that your uncapped score. But the maximum value, as we can see in the box on the left-hand side, the smaller box, we have a cap of 100, for, and that is for the surface water migration pathway. But if, for instance, we only had targets and environmental threat, we would only have 60 points for our surface water pathway because environmental threat is capped at 60. Okay, so let's look at another option. So we're going to assume for this particular scenario, and see, remember when we talked about quick score, I think on the module 3, I think, we mentioned that quick score is really cool because you can run so many different scenarios. You can just go back and plug in a different number, and immediately it's going to tell you what your target, what your score is going to be. So basically, as part of your planning process, you want to run some different scenarios so you can see what the site score is going to be. Then when you go out to the site, you can go ahead and, you know, try to collect those samples that are going to see whether or not you're going to be able to grab those points. So in this particular scenario, we're seeing that we're going to have potential. So we have 125 points for our potential. And when we apply the dilution weight of our surface water body and then we multiply by 0.1 or divide by 10, we only get 1.25 points, and we should round that up to a 1. I'm not sure why it did not round it up to 1. That's pretty interesting. Didn't just round it to 1 in this case, but generally you would round your potential targets to 1. So we can see in this particular scenario, we only get a 2.67, you know, for our environmental threat score. And then when we look over to the left, our pathway score is only 46. That's pretty low, you know. So that's not going to do a whole lot for us, especially if surface water pathway is the only pathway that we're looking at. Okay, so let's think about some things to think about when we evaluate our surface water pathway. Basically, when we're looking at our surface water pathway, we want to document whether or not we can document an observed release at the PPE. That's basically when you're looking at your surface water pathway, the first place that you would want to document an observed release is at the PPE. Do we have any drinking water intakes? Because basically, you know, we want points, and targets equal points. So we want to know whether or not there are any drinking water intakes. You know, we've talked about the perennial ditch. So our file information says it's not a fishery, but what if it is? What if you go out there and you see people fishing from it and you talk to them and they say, yes, I eat the fish I catch from it. Oh, that ditch has water in it all the time. And it has whatever kind of fish, you know, bass or bream or whatnot. And, you know, people are eating the fish. Then we can document that in our logbook and we can use those targets to score our site. Okay, so we know we've got the bayou and we've got the river and we have documentation on their fisheries. Can we document what the human food chain production is? Because let's say, for instance, our file information told us that we only have 10,000 pounds. So can we document whether or not there's more? Can we say, okay, if I want to go to the next breaking point, I'm going to get 31 points. And if I get 31 points, that's going to score my site. Then you might want to put a little bit more effort into it. But let's say, for instance, going from one breaking point to the other is going to be a far reach, and you wouldn't be able to document it, and it's not going to make a difference in your site score, then you might want to focus your efforts on something else that's going to give you those points. Because basically, it's all about trying to get those points. Okay, so basically, we would want to document, as we're looking at our SI, we want to document whether or not there's an observed release in the bayou and in the river, because we want to document observed release in our fisheries. What types of hazardous substances might be present in those particular surface water bodies at observed release, whether or not we have observed release in our sensitive environment. So all those things will be things that we're thinking about. Where am I going to collect my samples? You know, what hazardous substances am I going to be trying to shoot for? And based on what hazardous substances that you're looking at, should I collect a surface water sample? Should I collect a sediment sample? So those are some things to think about. Should I spend the time collecting a surface water sample when a sediment sample is going to do the job for me? So those are some things to think about. Assess whether or not you've got attribution issues. And we know that we had our river about 4.1 miles downstream, and our sensitive environments were very far, about 10 or so miles downstream for the critical habitat. Do you really think we're going to document that we have an observed release specifically from our site all the way 10 miles downstream? That's going to be a very hard one to document. So we know we're going to have attribution issues, so we may want to focus our efforts on the areas that we know for sure is going to give us those points that we can get. Okay, so we're going to take some questions. We're right at 3 o'clock right now, but we would like to take your questions. So, Mike, do we have any questions?
Thanks. Thank you, Sandra, and we appreciate everybody, if they could hold on for a few minutes here while we go through a few questions. Sandra, this one is from, I think, slide 69 or about. How do you consider the concentration or relative loading in the determination of which component to select for toxicity and persistence?
The concentration. Okay, so,
You don't.
Yeah.
I think that's a simple answer, Sandra. You don't. At this point, you're just considering what contaminants you have, and you're picking the contaminant that gives you the highest combined score when you add all three factors together if you're in human food chain threat.
Thank you. Then we have a couple about the fish. Do state-established fish consumption advisories meet level one and or level two documentation requirements?
State consumption advisories. So let's say, for instance, if you have a consumption advisory or even, say, complete prohibition, no fishing signs are posted. If people actually fish there and you have documentation that they fish there, you can use that particular surface water body as a fishery. But if, for instance, you don't have any documentation that people fish there, then you would not be able to use it as a fishery. So if you have samples collected, it doesn't matter if it's a state-designated advisory or if it's a federal advisory. As long as it's an advisory saying no fishing, you know, the fishery is closed, you can use it to score your site, whether or not you've got level one or level two. But you would need to have samples and document it that people actually catch the fish, and they also, at the HRS rule does not say that you have to document that they eat the fish. It basically says that there are human food chain organisms present, and people are attempting to harvest them. But nowadays, at the headquarters QA level, if you're working on an HRS package, then they like for you to document that people are actually eating those particular human food chain organisms.
Thanks. Regarding pounds of fish, does the pounds of fish per year include commercial and subsistence fishing?
Yes, it does. Yeah, it would.
Okay. How do you classify marine ecosystems from slide 592 under the water category when they are tidally influenced?
Okay, so slide
92. I think that's either when we have to either call them fresh or salt.
Yeah, so basically I think the marine estuary I would say would be a saltwater body. But, you know, sometimes you have tidal influence, like you've got, like, for instance, I know in Florida, the St. John's River is tidally influenced for very good distance. So if you know that you've got what is called, like, brackish water, you would select the higher of the two. So whenever you have that area that is tidally influenced, you can use the higher of the fresh or the saltwater value. And every now and then, the saltwater value gives you a higher value than the freshwater value.
Thanks. Okay, next question is, SCDMS surface water benchmarks are for water. What benchmarks would you use for sediment samples?
There are no benchmarks for sediment samples, and that's the reason why for sediment samples you can only evaluate level two. If the sample meets the observed release criteria, and for the human food chain, if you have a BCF factor value greater than 500 of a hazardous substance, then you can use a sediment sample to evaluate level two. But if, for instance, if it's the environmental threat, then if you have a sediment sample, then you would be using level two for your sediment sample.
Thanks. The next question is, would assimilative capacity be assessed?
I'm not sure what they mean by assimilative capacity.
I'm not sure either. If they're thinking assimilative capacity of the water body or the surface water to sort of dilute, I don't know, a discharge, then no. It's not. The only place dilution is taken into consideration is in the tables that Sandra showed you where you're doing potential population and your dilution weighting, the stream itself.
Thank you. I don't have any questions per se from a technical perspective. I did receive a question earlier regarding whether or not the audio problems we had today would affect us in the near future, and the answer to that is I don't know. We do know that it was beyond our control, and not throwing them under the bus, but we know that the issue is coming from the Adobe servers. They have a service interruption announcement, but I also know that they also had scheduled maintenance for Monday, not during business hours. So we are hoping and reasonably confident that whatever issue they have, we would think they could fix between now and then. So I hope the answer is we hope so. We hope that the audio will be normal for the next seminar. So do you guys have any final thoughts?
No, other than the next seminar is this coming Monday from 1 to 3, and we'll finish up the preliminary assessment portion by doing the preliminary scoring for the air and soil pathways using the ABC vacuum site. So that's all we have.
Okay, and I got a few last things here. We've got, if you're not familiar, we've got a few new ways to connect to us here on CLUIN through a couple of social media sites, Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. For those of you looking for records of your attendance in today's CLUIN Internet seminar, please visit the following webpage. You can enter your email address and have a list of all webinars registered under your name emailed to you for your own records. If you require further assistance, please feel free to contact Jean Balint at balint.jean@epa.gov. That is also on the first of the starting slides in today's seminar. We'd like to thank you again for joining today's live webinar. I'd like to remind participants that slides and other items related to today's session can be found at the seminar resources page. Associated with a links page is the online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form today. That applies to those watching the recorded version of today's session as well. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Although we don't issue certificates for our webinars, you may find that a copy of your registration email, the seminar slides, and the feedback confirmation email are enough to document your participation in today's event, depending on your accrediting institution. Furthermore, today's session was recorded, and in the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive in approximately 2 weeks. And as a side note for specifically today's seminar, I do not know how today's audio problems will affect both the future availability and the timing of the archive. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. And so that's it. Thank you for attending today's session. Hope you found it to be valuable. And again, Module 6 is on Monday. Thank you.